recommend it. It's a great addition, especially if you didn't play them originally, because it's Pokemon. It's always going to be good.
Hey, pal. Hey, send me that first Words with Friends, and we'll get a game going on.
Sounds like a plan. I will be texting you the Scrabble.
Right on, man. Talk to you next month.
I'll be here.
Bye. Jaden, twitter.com/TheEternal. Also, check out Jaden at the We Talk Games Video Power Magazine message boards, wetalkgames.com. Get on board, and we can try to do that Words with Friends social experiment. All right, now I have to hook up this Ritim device here. I have to put these two things on my templates. There's stickers with wires hanging out. Okay, put them under my hat here. And then I'm to press this button. This is the WOG system. It is based on the transcription of the current episode, and I guess some sort of alpha waves from my brain or something, which will cross-reference a real-time keyword database and generate the most relevant special guest for our current episode. And what, dial it, Keith? All right, here goes. I'll just turn the switch on here. Ritim. Okay.
We are our guests.
That's funny. Ow! Ow! It's like singed my temples. Ow! All right. See what it says here? Today's special guest will be, oh wow! With over 20 years of game programming experience, a great run of Mac games and iPhone games, the Fothergill brothers from Strange Flavor and Freeverse. Get them on the line, Keith! Newcastle, United Kingdom! The Fothergill brothers, Aaron and Adam Fothergill of Strange Flavor. Now, I know that you're from the UK because you have that U in there.
Yeah, we spell it properly.
Right. Been told that many, many a time. I'd like to thank both of you for joining us on We Talk Games. I've been a big fan of yours. I don't know if it was OS 8, but definitely OS 9 and my Pismo PowerBook G3 Firewire.
Oh, yeah, when we first did Bushfire and Airburst, that was just as I was trying to be convinced by OSX.
Uh-huh, yes.
So we kind of wrote it as a let's play with OSX kind of thing. I was on my iBook back then. I had the first iBook in the UK.
Wow.
And Adam had the second. That was one of the funky iBooks as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, they were cool.
Probably didn't have FireWire or anything like that. It was just the toilet seat.
And more importantly, the screen size was only 800 by 600.
Right, yes.
Entirely why both Bushfire and Airburst only work properly at 800 by 600.
I see. Well, let me tell you, both those games, but especially Airburst, that was my game. I loved that title. I played that for hours and hours, and that's kind of unusual for me to sit down and play for long stretches of time, but that contained elements of all the different types of game genres that I really enjoyed.
Yeah, I mean, we started with a really simple idea, because I had always wanted to do a game like Warlords.
Oh, right.
Yeah, and that was kind of the first games. I mean, when I started on the Apple II, and the first games I really kind of got into, the arcades and so on. So Breakout was the first game I ever saw in color. And it was like really simple, but the whole thing of just breaking things, it was great, you know. And it's so much more stress-relieving than Space Invaders at the time.
Gotcha.
Then I saw Warlords like twice, and I had this thing in my head of, you know, the Breakout thing. So I kind of specced up a vague idea of a thing with flying castles. And then Adam kind of piped us, oh, what about trying to make it more cute and go with balloons?
Uh-huh.
I don't know how that came about, but I think it was just, yeah, it was just the simplicity of it, I think, wasn't it? Yeah, that was it. I was cool with that because balloons are a lot easier to actually manipulate on screen than knocking bricks out of castles and making the whole thing kind of do dirt flying everywhere and so on. And it's more colourful.
And it helps the castles to float.
Of course. Yeah, that's right. And of course, there's a lot of different physics came out of that as well in the gameplay.
Definitely.
Doing balloons and stuff. And it keep going kind of more cute and silly. Then we could start thinking, right, okay, what's the fun things we remember from all that type of games? So we had fruit-type power-ups, and then we got into my favorite thing, generated levels, rather than having to sit down and design levels. So I design how the levels generate rather than the levels individually. So I came up with some pretty horrific formulas for how the levels work. So effectively, each level generates based on the power-ups that are on the level.
Oh, I see. Wow.
Yeah, the formulas for it are horrific. So the original Airburst was millions of levels, which I only really thought about OCD people later. I can imagine, you know, some poor subs out there. I know people did get to level 4,000 plus.
Wow.
These are guys who found kind of holes in the original version. You could put it on four-player mode and then leave it. No computer players to knock the human players out. It would just keep going. They'd leave it on overnight to see how high they could get it.
That's great. That was around the year 2000, right?
I think we might have released it in 2001.
Oh, 2001. That's right. That's right.
Yeah,
okay, very
good. We were both working at Argonaut at the time. And we kind of had a very fluky contract in that we'd been bought from another company, and effectively everyone from that company had been kind of re-employed by Argonaut, and the company we were at then had also had the same thing. We'd been grabbed from another company. I'd done one job interview in my entire career.
Wow.
The deal I had with the first company I was working for was that it was known I would be messing around with my own games in my spare time. And because I was still into experimenting with the idea of writing Mac games then, and nobody else then liked Macs. It was an alien thing to the game industry in the UK.
Sure.
Backward. And they said, yeah, okay, no problem. We'll do it in your contract. But as long as it's not competing with stuff we're doing, it's in your own spare time, you can write all the Mac games you want. So, okay, cool, you know. And so that actually carried through in both our contracts all the way through the Argonaut years. We just had to let them know, you know, if we were working on anything, submit it just in case they want to sort of publish it. But mostly they just let us get on with it, which is great.
Oh, okay. So you worked at Argonaut before you started your own company then?
Yeah, we'd done our own company before then and had a very bad time of it eventually doing ST and Amiga stuff. And it went horribly, horribly wrong for various reasons. And, you know, got some cult games out of it, but then decided to go and work for someone else. I worked for Electric Spectacle up in Newcastle for about a year and a half. And they got bought by Cranberry Sauce in London, and they got bought by Argonaut, and ended up there for, I think, nearly 10 years.
Wow. That did strike me as a bit odd. Here are these two brothers from the UK making games for the Macintosh, and I was very excited to have you on because I've been a Mac enthusiast since, I guess, not as long as you. I didn't start on the Apple II, but I did start around 1993, and my first computer was a Mac 2SI. Now, were you a fan of, like, a lot of the HyperStack card games? Did you make your own HyperStack games?
I actually missed most of it.
Okay.
That was what bugged me, because I really liked the idea of it. And I'd seen some of the American ones that had the kind of more open educational qualities. Because in the UK, we suddenly had this fit of educational stuff where it has to fit a curriculum, and you have to have key elements, and you're not allowed to do educational stuff that's outside of that. Otherwise, you get people from the government kind of saying, oh, that's bad, and so on.
I see.
It was very difficult to market an educational game that was just kind of more free thinking. And I can't remember the one. There was a really great HyperCard one in the States. I can't remember what it was called, but basically it had this character who's just doing, just kind of wandering around doing random cool stuff on each stack. It was encouraging kids to just kind of explore.
Yeah, there were a lot of story-driven titles.
Yeah. I kind of always liked the idea of sort of HyperCard and hyperlinking kind of stuff. I kind of experimented with them a bit, but never really particularly usefully. And then by the time I got back into Mac programming properly, you know, where I had actual proper time and an actual working Mac to do it again, it kind of gone away, you know. I'd kind of unfortunately missed most of it.
Right on. How did you go about releasing your first titles for the Macintosh?
Badly, I think. No, actually, because we were doing them spare time, we couldn't get a publisher because, of course, we're working for a company that is also working for a publisher. So we thought, okay, well, we'll just do it really seriously shareware. We had a go at using a tipping jar site. And I can't remember what they're called, but they changed their names. So they're actually for musicians. The idea was we did it so that you could pay directly by post, and a few people could just send money through the post. I still remember at the time the whole thing of not having a credit card and you not being able to pay online or anything like that.
Right.
A major hassle for most of us back then. The test for Bushfire was making it £2 or $3 or something like that. Really simple, just money you can send through the post. And then we found this site that was doing tips for musicians. The idea was it was a guilt trip thing. If you downloaded some music off Napster and you're feeling guilty about it and thought that the musician should be getting some money, you'd go on this site and give them a dollar. You know, you'd say who it's for. And a lot of indie musicians got in on it and decided this is a great idea. We'll put our stuff online for free and let people tip us. And we were doing okay. And then we came along and said, oh, well, actually, this is great for us. Use this site to tip us with a couple of bucks a time and we'll send you a registration code.
Right.
Because it tells you, you can put your email details and stuff in. And it worked great. And we used that for Bushfire and then for Airburst One. And then they got bought by a big music corporation that just basically disappeared.
How did your teaming with Freeverse come about?
That was actually driven from that. They got into Airburst and said, oh, we want to do some stuff with you guys. And we had to kind of arrange a few things and get some OKs from Argonaut, because us having a publisher while we're actually working for them, you know, it was a bit odd.
Sure.
Because we had to make sure there's no conflict of interest. We had to be pretty paranoid about it. You know, we had all sorts of things like, you know, we didn't really want to do Windows games anyway, but we had to make sure it was kind of a deal that we would only do Mac games for Freeverse and they would not port it to anything.
You know, I see.
Just in case it conflicted with something Argonaut was doing. So they said, you know, let's write some. And we'd been messing around with video camera stuff and accidentally kind of wrote Toyside.
I see. Well, I own that one as well, yeah.
Yeah, that one was kind of a weird one. We were going through some nasty times, the neighbor from hell problem.
Ah.
And or from heck, actually. That's probably a people one. And because what we do is, because we only wrote it in our spare time, we'd only write stuff on our holidays, so we'd take 2 weeks off to write again.
I see.
And the idea was we planned to write Toyside on this 2 weeks off we'd had booked between projects we were both on at Ardmore. Got home, and it was riots going on. There was the kids out in the street trying to attack police cars and harass all the neighbours, and we decided, yeah, it's probably not the ideal situation.
My goodness.
Yeah, so we played off down to our mum's place and worked off her dining room table for 2 weeks.
Wow. Where does an idea for Toyside come from?
Toyside, like I said, was kind of an accident. I was messing around with QuickTime stuff for Airburst Extreme and found out that I could read the camera in on it. And then, of course, messing around with reading the camera in on it to see if I can do motion detection. So then it was a case of sitting down and thinking up mini games that would suit. At the time, Sony were doing iToyCore, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And we had not really been following it because we hadn't been doing anything for Sony at the time. So the thing was a case of, okay, well, we'll purposely avoid looking at iToy stuff because, A, Sony have a very odd idea about it, and they were doing some very, very clever research and stuff. But we didn't want to mess with that, you know. It's
sure.
Okay, let's just write some stuff that we think we'd have fun with, different types of game with these controls. And it was kind of almost like an experiment, really, of it, see how these controls actually work. So we ended up with a bit of a variety. We wanted to try and do multiplayer because we saw it obviously as a kind of a party thing. So you had quite a few sort of two-player games and stuff in there.
Mm-hmm.
And then we decided we had to do some more over-the-top stuff. So the Owl and the Pussycat was a very freaky one in that we actually decided, okay, let's do a proper 2D platform game, but where you're actually flapping your arms to control it. And that one sort of came about. Island God was the classic one because that was a case of, okay, thinking way ahead of things, of course, was what would Peter Molyneux do if he had motion control? He would write Populous. So we did a Populous game where you sort of fairly miniaturized version of Populous where you play a god and you just have to quickly control stuff on the island. And all of them were designed around the basis that we have so little time to write it. So it's got to be written, mostly it's down to Adam's sort of art style in that we have to be kind of perfectionist on the styling.
Mm-hmm.
And look, it can't be kind of half-finished sort of for the game. So we have to keep them very small and very simple and fun.
Right.
So it's kind of did that one. And, of course, coming along sort of nearly 10 years later, and Pete Molyneux's now got motion control, and, you know, I'm betting he's going to do a Populous game.
Right. Is that how this team works? How you divvy up the tasks for your games?
Well, I do the main part of the game design. Adam tends to pitch in on ideas on that. And usually we just argue about it for ages until we come up with something we're happy with. But I kind of get controlling thing on game design. And I also do all the coding. And then Adam does all the art, his complete overview of the general sort of art design. And, of course, all the sound and music.
Okay.
But that can sometimes influence the game design as well, because I'll sometimes come up with a bit of artwork and then Aaron will go, oh, we can do this or that. Yeah, right. I mean, that's entirely what airburst down the path it went along.
Sure. I'm sure you never had in mind giant stuffed animals sitting on top of your castles.
No, exactly, yeah.
And those characters really caught on.
Yeah, I mean, we got some really great fan emails and stuff. I've still got a picture on my wall, actually. Some kid sent in a painting done of the four characters, so I was well chuffed for that. And in fact, it was Mac Addict, the print magazine.
Sure.
They had a competition years back to dress up as your favourite games character. And the guy that won it actually was dressed up as Flux with a complete ring of balloons around him. And he had his head shaved bald and painted red and white. It was brilliant.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Now, when you were making games for the Mac and you were making Bushfire and making Airburst and Airburst Extreme, and then when you started designing games for Freeverse, I'm sure even back then, Freeverse, I mean, what did they have out? They had Jarrett, they had Sim Stapler, they had the...
When we sort of started working with them, they'd already got the Burning Monkey series out.
Which was amazing.
And Wingnuts, of course.
Wingnuts.
So they were pretty well established for Mac games, so we were quite happy to sort of team up with them. You know, because it's a case of these are people who can really kind of start pushing our stuff to the right people.
And they have a very high art concept ethic as well.
Exactly, yes. Yeah. So
real quality titles.
Push us to kind of, you know, make sure we didn't slack off or anything.
Sure, sure. But I'm sure no one was prepared for the iPhone, the iPad, and the explosion of the success that came out of that.
Yeah, the thing was, we were all complaining like crazy when the iPhone came out and Apple didn't let us in on it.
I see.
It was a case of, you know, this is the perfect platform for us. You know, we've done everything from GBA upwards, so, and Freeverse have been, you know, we've got guys there who have been working on everything, sort of, you know, sort of all sorts of platforms. And it seemed crazy not to allow devs to play on it. And then Apple kind of went the opposite totally and let every dev on it, which was also a bit crazy, but yeah, it kind of worked out for them.
Yeah. Isn't Flick Fishing one of the most successful iPod games of all time?
It's not the most successful in terms of numbers yet. I think we're about third in numbers, I think, possibly fourth. I think Doodle Jump's actually overtaken everybody now. I think they're claiming about 3 million now.
Oh, I see.
I know Pocket God's done a couple of million, and I think Flight Control's pushing a couple of million. And I think at the moment, Flick Fishing's actually just on the 2 million mark. We've also sold a lot of in-app purchases as well.
I definitely want to take a look at Flick Fishing, if you don't mind, because this is really a game that works perfectly on the iPod, the iPhone. The interface, the complexity of the title itself, it just sort of fits perfectly for this type of spare time gaming.
Yeah, it was one of these games originally I didn't actually want to do.
Okay.
And Adam had this idea for a way of doing water, because we'd been talking to Freeverse about the Flick games and stuff, and what we do is both of us will annoy Ian and Colin from time to time by pitching them crazy ideas. And most of the time, it's actually ones we don't want to do, we just kind of want them to do it and see if they can come up with something. But on Flick Fishing, Adam actually came up with the idea. As he actually wrote most, you did most of Plank, didn't you, Adam?
Oh, yeah, I did, yeah. That's the start of it.
Yeah, because the idea was we'd test the waters with the iPhone to make sure our setup was good for working on it. So we got our first Intel Mac, we got a MacBook in to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I was carrying on my stuff, but I'm kind of giving you info on how to convert Plank over from the ToySight version.
Uh-huh.
Simplest one to do that we could expand. Mm. So Adam did most of the grunt work on that, and we were designing kind of other games, and Flick Fishing kind of came up as one of the first ones we thought of while Freeverse were getting on with their launch titles. I'd said, oh, let's do a fishing, we should do a fishing game, but we're not too sure about doing it. And Adam came up with the idea of how to do the water and how to put the graphics together to make it look right for the iPhone.
Mm.
And they said, yeah, you guys have got to do this. You know, it's like, okay, we'll do it. You know, so I had to go away and think about fishing games and how fishing games worked. The best ones, you know, because I've played a lot of them.
Sure.
But there's this key element, and same with any game, there's always key elements of the game that's critical. It's not so much about being a great fisherman and knowing everything. You get experts in for that. So we're lucky in that our mum's partner is an ex-fisherman.
Oh, great.
So he's done fishing, you know, everything from casual angling to full-on fishing at sea, on a trawler and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So he had a lot of useful information. And rather than becoming kind of fishing nuts that don't know how to write games, it's a case of, okay, we'll focus on what we know how to do, get the game right, and Adam, of course, sits down and works out how to get the art right so it will look right for everybody.
Mm.
But part of getting the game right is making you feel that you're in the game. You have to have that kind of illusion that you're into it, same as a film or anything.
Oh, yeah. I was quite surprised at the look of this title, especially when you're surfing on the ocean there. And
yeah. We've got people complaining they were getting seasick.
Yeah.
Actually, wait till you see the HD version. That's hopefully that going through at the moment. So, you know, we keep our fingers crossed on that one.
Very good.
It's kind of getting all that right and just the right amount of fishing data. There's a lot of complaints about it's a bit silly because you've got the bobber all the time. And actually, that's a very deliberate gameplay element because you're focused on that on screen. If you're doing it realistically and just having the line into the water, you don't have anything to focus on. So you just don't get the gameplay right. The timing's all wrong and so on.
Sure.
And you don't want to be waiting half an hour to catch a fish when you've got a game in your hand and you're on a train or something. You know,
right.
You want to actually be playing the gameplay elements of it. So we kind of tuned it down. The idea was it was kind of a fishing microcosm or something. You know, it's all the elements of the fun parts of fishing games all in one thing. And we kept our fingers crossed, you know, that it would kind of all work, because you can never tell.
Yeah, sometimes you can't tell until it's almost complete if the whole thing will work.
Yeah, I mean, you know, especially with the iPhone market, because it's a very different market for most of us. Not the big mass of absolute hardcore gamers out there. You know, there's a lot of very, very casual gamers.
Sure.
And just lots of people who've never played a game before in their life, and you really are trying to see if you can get them into playing games with this sort of stuff, and a lot of the time it just doesn't work.
I think before Flick Fishing, I think my favorite fishing game was Sega Bass Fishing for the Dreamcast with the controller.
Yeah, I mean, I played a couple of the deep sea fishing ones on the PC when we were writing Croc 2 for the PlayStation. That most of the team would kind of take breaks and see if they could catch the biggest fish kind of between coding sessions. And that was kind of typical for that. And then all these games kind of evolved along a certain path of each game must have this.
I feel sort of out of touch with my guests. I usually know a lot about my guests, and I'm afraid that I wasn't even aware that you developed for so many other different consoles and systems.
Yeah, it's actually kind of like working in a big company like that, because you're just one of a team. Adam actually worked in a totally different department, which was quite weird. It's the first time we've not worked together.
Mm-hmm.
Right, we knew working on completely different games most of the time as well. So,
I see.
I mean, I did, PlayStation 1 stuff. I was on the first Harry Potter game. The guys that I worked with on the first Harry Potter game have just won two BAFTAs for their Batman Arkham Asylum game.
Oh, fantastic.
Most of that team went on to start their own company after Argonaut shut down.
So what about the iPad? I really haven't talked about this with any of our guests, and now you two are the first people I've talked to that are going to actually have titles on the iPad. Is this something that's exciting to you?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of a part of it, same as most of the iPad devs, or hopefully, in theory, all of the iPad devs, we're kind of developing blind. We've all only been able to really use the simulator.
Right.
We came up with a technique that we guesstimated that if we use the sim, and then the 3GS is about the same kind of theoretically memory map and speed. So we kind of cross-compile for the 3GS and test a lot of elements on that and so on. So we get a reasonable approximation. And a lot of the devs have had to do the same thing. And then you kind of throw it to Apple and they say yay or nay whether it actually does work or not. We should have some good stuff coming out with that, but we're all nervous, basically. And we're even worse, because we're in the UK, we don't actually see it until a lot later.
Right. Now, one thing I was sort of unaware of as well was that Slots Racer, you were behind Slots Racer for the iPod, the iPhone, and I didn't know, like, the barrier between the West and the Wester, I don't know really even the proper terms, but between the United States and the UK, I didn't know that AFX and slot car racing, I didn't know how that played in the UK. Was that popular?
We found it very strange. And Freeverse said, oh, we don't want you to do a slot car racing game because we've never heard of it in the US. And despite actually one of the guys on the Freeverse forums, a guy called Slot Car Bob, who was one of our testers, he's actually based in the States, and he is an absolute slot car nut. And he tested for us and kind of reassured Freeverse that, yes, even though it never really took off in the States, there was enough of a core fan base there for it to at least be okay. And we knew, because we're both Grand Prix nuts, and I had electric sets as a kid, and we actually went to research at our mum's, because she actually collects them for some obscure reason.
Oh, wow.
So we actually went up to her place to get her old set out and mess around with that to do some research. We knew it had core countries it would be successful in, to a point, but it was more kind of doing it because it's something we wanted to do for fun, you know, it was a game we wanted to play. And we were quite pleased because it took off in UK, Spain, and Portugal, which are always key ones for slot car racing. Went straight to number one in Germany. By the end of its first week, it hit number one in most countries apart from America.
I see.
And it got to number three in America on the basis of it doing well everywhere else. In fact, the forum fans at Touch Arcade actually were a good part of that because they started asking questions about it. So I was sort of corresponding with them on the forums, and they took to it really well. So I think a lot of the word of it got out from things like Touch Arcade forums and so on. And I'm weird, because it is a one-button game.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of all the elements of slot car racing was the idea. We just wanted to just make it fun.
Sure, yeah. You just press down a lever and that gives it.
But it was kind of quite strange explaining it to a lot of Americans who'd only seen the Tyco ones, where I think they got kind of desperate in the States to try and get the concept to work out there in the 80s. So they released all these weird ones with guns and fighter jets and loop-de-loops and all this kind of thing, and it got away from it being a racing set.
Sure.
So it kind of confused people when they saw it, because I think a lot of people thought the idea was you're playing on a straight loop or something, or on a figure of eight. But with those, they're very simple slot racing. So what you do is you find the exact point on the accelerator where you just let the car run around on its own at that speed constantly, and you'll never come off. And because the other guy comes off because he's trying to accelerate and decelerate, you'll probably win. And in proper slot car racing, it's actually about accelerating and decelerating more than holding a steady speed.
Sure.
So with a complicated track. So a lot of people didn't quite get the idea that you actually had to take your finger off the button sometimes to decelerate. So once you got that across, you know, most people got it. So it did well. It's our favourite game of our ones. It's one we always go back to mess around with. And we've been experimenting with updates, but of course the priority is always going to be on, and the publisher's always pushing us for either the new stuff or for working obviously on Flick Fishing to keep that current.
Sure.
Because there's a lot of people want little tweaks and little bits that they'd like us to tune and add on that one. And Slots, it's a case of we've got some very, very fun stuff worked out for the iPad that we've worked up on the sim. And there's lots of stuff we just want to do in it, you know, at various points. So hopefully that's just going to get, you know, bigger and bigger as we release more stuff.
Cannot wait. Warpack Grunts, let's talk about that.
Oh, yeah, that was a fun one.
This is my style of game, this type of go-through, throw grenades at people and shoot tiny little players. What was the inspiration behind this, as if I don't know?
It was kind of an obvious one, you know, in Cannon Fodder and all the games like Cannon Fodder. So it's one on the Sega, I think it was Major Chaos or something.
Sure, yep.
I think it was one of the ones that inspired Cannon Fodder originally.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole mini guys wargaming. And we have this kind of backstory thing for the Warpack genre. It's kind of theoretically a long-running sequence of games that may or may not ever happen.
Right.
Technically, this is actually a prequel to the Warpack stuff, but each game's very different style.
I see.
But there's kind of a backstory to the whole thing. But we thought, you know, let's just do a fun little arcade game where you run around and shoot and blow people up.
And who wrote the dialogue for this?
That was me. Yeah,
very.
My usual. I've got very tongue-in-cheek cynical with my dialogue over the years.
Yes, indeed.
Way back when we were working for Cranberry, they were writing a game called Quad, which eventually got called Quintessential Art of Destruction, but actually stood for Quick and Dirty. Back then it was recognized that pretty much the plot for every single shooting game going was really, really rubbish. You know, it was just some made-up junk that never fit the game, and you could throw anything in. So the first thing we did for Quad was wrote the thing called ENID, the Engine of Narrative Interactive Destruction, which just made up stories on the fly. So every level you played in the game, it made up some excuse for why you're going around shooting everything.
That's fantastic.
And that's kind of carried on, I think, at every time. There's very, very few games. I think Bioshock's one of the best ones for actually having a story that gets you into it.
Sure.
And Deus Ex, of course, which was a good one. But most of the time, really, you don't need to listen to the story. Grunts, the storyline, is kind of let's have a generic bad guy. We're going to put him in South America because every single game where you're shooting a terrorist is set in South America.
Sure.
You know, there's even a case of it's a generic South American country because, you know, whenever they do these things, they never say which country in South America it is. It's just some kind of South American-y kind of country. And it's really unfair on South America. It's probably a really nice place with no terrorists at all, but, you know, they need to set the game somewhere, of course.
Sure, sure.
And then we had Evil Dude, of course, because we had to have a generic Evil Dude. And Generalissimo. It's just a case of having to have really all the elements of the Bond and Rainbow Six and all that kind of thing there as a general plotline, so we could actually just give you an excuse to kill people.
Right. It does that quite well, quite well. Speaking of the Bioshock series and newer things, and the fact that you had Max, were there any other unusual gaming systems, gaming consoles that are near and dear to your heart that you endear to, and what are you playing now?
Still playing on the 360. I've been really, really chewing through Borderlands.
Okay.
I love that one. Just the random gun thing is great. I've got to the point now where I've got it. I think you end up getting one good gun early on and realise actually, no matter how random the later guns are, there's always this one gun you always end up using. But it still rocks.
Yes.
It's very, very good stress. I think Adam's going to be playing, what's it called? What's the one you're into, Adam, that we've got the new version coming out soon?
Just Cause.
Oh, of course.
Really waiting for that.
Yeah. Got that on pre-order.
I see.
I think I can stop playing GTA, but yeah. Of course. But I've played that to death, so.
How about classic gaming systems? Anything that was unusual that you had in the earlier years?
Oh, CD32. We wrote one of the top games for that.
Really?
Yeah, we wrote Jet Strike years and years ago. And if you can find the CD32 version of Base Jumpers for that, that's a real rarity. We wrote that one basically just as we were going bust at the time. And that was a chuckle, but some of the other games on it were great. We ended up spending more time playing them than writing for it. Because it was the absolute poorly designed, poorly thought out, poorly marketed, poorly built, and just disappeared into obscurity really quickly. But there was some fun stuff on it.
Right on. As a game player and a Mac enthusiast, I cannot wait for the iPad. I hope, as a developer, the future looks just as bright for you.
Yeah, I mean, we've got all the new stuff coming up, of course. So, you know, buy our games, which is what keeps us. We're not rich, unfortunately. It's always quite funny seeing this whole thing of, iPod developers must be extremely rich. And no, you just have to pay off lots of debt.
I see.
And the community's quite strange. We haven't actually released anything new for a while because of going back. We hit the classic wall of we wrote all this stuff early on, and then of course go back and update it, and then you realise it's 6 months to a year have gone by and you haven't released anything new.
Right.
So we'll be remedying that one soon enough, you know.
Very good. Aaron and Adam Fothergill, thank you very much for stopping by and talking games with us, and we look forward to picking up all of your games on the iPod, iPad, and a Mac. Head on over to strangeflavor.com. Remember, we can't spell flavor without you. And also stop over to freeverse.com and find out all the things that they've created for that fine company. Thanks, fellas.
Thanks.
Right on. Bye now.
Bye.
Stinky, if you would have told me 2 years ago that I would have the creators of Amiga CD32's Jet Strike and PlayStation 1's Croc 2 on our show, I would have thought you were crazy. And here we are today. Seriously, fantastic to have him on. I've been a fan of Strange Flavor ever since I first saw their OpenGL psychedelic background underneath their logo. We'll have to have them on in the future to talk about their years at Argonaut. Hey, let's start our youth-based stretch of correspondence. Let's get Kirby on the line. Snowapolis! Kirby.
Wiggly World, 119, go.
Yes, using the telephone effect. Hey, Kirby, great to have you on here on this beautiful day. And by beautiful, I mean I'm standing in 13 inches of water in the chicken coop. But, you know, March showers bring April showers. And
even more wetness and lovely.
Yes, sir. Hey, what do you got for us this fine month there, Kirby?
As I claim to be the resident RPG nerd and also a bit of a BioWare fanboy, I got BioWare's latest space odyssey epic thing, Mass Effect 2.
All right, now the Mass Effect 2. Now the effect is, of course, some type of tremolo, a phase shifter, maybe a little bit of Lennon flange piano going on.